This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The poet Wallace Stevens once wrote, "A poet looks at the world as a man looks at a woman." Some years later, another poet, Ruth Stone, deconstructed that idea in her poem called, quite simply, Words. She said, "I can never know what a man sees when he looks at a woman. That is a sealed universe." Ruth Stone's path in life took her through the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where she attended college. She went on to become an accomplished poet, despite the many obstacles she faced. She was a woman in the mid-20th century in a world of poetry that was still dominated by men, and she had to raise three daughters on her own after her second husband, Walter, died by suicide. But she persevered, and her work was influenced by her life's experiences. She lived to the age of 96, dying at her longtime home in Goshen, Vermont, in late 2011. Ruth's home is now on the National Register of Historic Places, and her life and her home are now the subject of a documentary. It's called Ruth Stone's Vast Library of the Female Mind. It aired on PBS stations across the country back in March and April, and it's still available to stream on the PBS Passport app. The maker of the documentary, Nora Jacobson, spent 12 years seeing it to completion. She's an independent filmmaker, and she's made award-winning films on topics ranging from mental illness to feminism through her production company, Off the Grid Productions. We spoke with her about the movie back in March. Because our program's on tape today, we're not taking calls live, but we do want to hear what you thought, so you can send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now, filmmaker Nora Jacobson. So I want to begin by asking, what did you know about Ruth Stone before you started making this documentary?
You know, that's funny. It's usually the first question that someone asks me at a Q&A after a screening. And the answer is very simply that I didn't know a thing about her. I was called up on the phone by another poet, Gerard Niord, Vermont Poet Laureate, and he said, "I've been interviewing elder poets, and the last one I'm doing is of this woman, Ruth Stone, and she has a really interesting presence, and I think you might be interested in coming up and doing a video interview with her." So I grabbed my camera and a sound person, and we traveled over to Goshen, Vermont, where she was living about an hour and a half from me. And I spent the day interviewing Ruth. I thought just for this, for Chard, as a favor to Chard, who wanted to sort of preserve her image on video. But by the end of the day, I was so taken by her presence, her incandescent face and her blunt honesty, that I thought she would make a great subject for a documentary. So I asked her and her family if that would be okay. And they said, "Yeah, sure." You know, they wanted Ruth to be known more widely. And I think they thought maybe a film about her might do that. So, you know, I went back up there like four or five times, and then put the footage aside for a while because I had some other work I had to do, and then continued on later. Unfortunately, Ruth died in 2011, but I did have those five or six really great interviews with her. And then the rest, well, I collected the footage, you know, little by little. And you can, if you want, you can ask me about that too.
Yeah, I will. But say more about her presence, though. I think you use the word incandescent, which is a rather poetic word. But what does that mean in person?
Well, it just means that, first of all, if you look at her skin, even at 94, her skin was this very pale white that reflected light. And so just her skin itself. And then her eyes were very large, and she just stared straight ahead. She was actually almost blind at the time, but you wouldn't have really known it by looking at her. But she looked at you, or she looked close. She seemed to be looking straight at you when she answered questions. And in my case, looking right into the camera. I'm the kind of filmmaker that likes my subjects to really look right into the lens, not off to one side. So it was her directness, the direct gaze, that made me feel that she would be a wonderful subject for a documentary.
Like the Errol Morris Interotron effect. I love it.
Yes, exactly.
We have a clip, some clips from the film, and you found great past footage of Ruth to use, and I want to share some of that. This is Ruth Stone in 1973 reading her poem, Advice. Let's take a listen, and then we need to go to a break right after that.
My hazard wouldn't be yours, not ever. But every doom, like a hazelnut, comes down to its own worm. So I'm rocking here like any granny with her apron over her head saying, Lordy me, it's my trouble. There's nothing to be learned this way. If I heard a girl crying help, I would go to save her. But you hardly ever hear these words. Dear children, you must try to say something when you are in need. Don't confuse hunger with greed, and don't wait until you are dead.
All right, we need to take a short break. More on the life and times of poet Ruth Stone coming up. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're listening back to a conversation we first aired in March about the poet Ruth Stone. She's the subject of a documentary, Ruth Stone's Vast Library of the Female Mind. It's currently available to stream on the PBS Passport app and website. We talk with the filmmaker behind the documentary, Nora Jacobson. She first met Ruth Stone almost as a favor to someone else, but she was captivated and spent the better part of, if not even a little longer than a decade, working on this project. Our program's on tape today, so we're not taking calls live, but we always appreciate hearing what you thought about the show. So send an email to talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. So let's talk more about Ruth's background. One of the reasons that she caught our attention is that she attended the University of Illinois. How did that time influence her life and by extension her poetry?
Well, I don't think she ever graduated. I don't think she has a college degree per se. She attended classes for a couple of years, I believe, but she met her first husband and then her second husband, Walter Stone, there. So it was very crucial and critical because of meeting the love of her life, Walter Stone, her second husband.
Interesting. We'll say more about him and their relationship.
Yeah. Well, he was a student. He was a few years younger than Ruth, and they met through friends. Friends introduced them by chance, I guess. But Walter claims that it was love at first sight for him. And Ruth also says that it was electric. There was this electric shock between them. But, you know, she was married. And then her first husband was rather abusive and had hurt her, had actually hit her across the face. And she claims that she had fell out of love with him. And eventually they divorced and she married Walter. So that's how it happened. You know, she and Walter were madly, madly in love. He got a PhD and then went on to teach at Vassar College. Of course, there was the war in between, and he did go off to war. I think he was in the Philippines, and they wrote back and forth, thousands of letters back and forth to each other. And then when he got out, he got a job at Vassar, and she moved to Vassar with him. She had a little girl at the time already with John, her first husband, Marcia. And so they raised Marcia, and then eventually they had their two other daughters. But somewhere in that time period, Ruth went off on a little adventure looking for a country house. And she found this house in Goshen, Vermont, which she bought with a poetry award that she had received, unbeknownst to Walter. Walter didn't know that she bought this house. It was very, very cheap at the time. It was in the, you know, the late 50s. And she bought the house. And apparently Walter was a little bit upset because he wasn't making that much money as a professor at Vassar, but she bought it and it ended up being her home.
Interesting. Well, and you, so I mentioned that her relationship with Walter ended in tragedy, right? Walter died by suicide, and she was left to pick up the pieces of their life, her family, her three daughters. How did the family cope with that in the moment and in the years to come?
I think in the moment, it was a very strange event, really, because apparently there was no warning. There are multiple stories about that, actually. Each family member sort of has a different interpretation of the weeks leading up to that, to the suicide. They were living in London, or outside of London, where Walter was on sabbatical from Vassar. And he he killed himself in London in a rented room. He had an office there. So the family found out, they packed up and took a boat back to the United States. And as you find out in the film, the littlest girl, Abigail, who was only five, wasn't told that her dad had died, which is a story in and of itself. They came back, though, and various friends tried to help Ruth, and she got a job with, the Weekly Reader, I guess, writing textbooks for kids. But then she started to get one-year teaching appointments, and friends helped her get those jobs. And she would pack the kids in the car and drive across the country, drive wherever she had to go to teach. So she had to make a living. They had no money, and she had no money, and she wasn't well educated enough to have a good job. But she was this poet. She was a wonderful poet. So people hired her to teach creative writing, but usually these one-year appointments. So it was a very peripatetic life. And they always had this home in Goshen, Vermont to return to in the summers or whenever they could. And that was it. And I think it affected all the daughters deeply in different ways. And of course, it affected Ruth particularly, because she wrote about Walter and about what happened in different ways, not melancholy necessarily, not morose. I mean, her poetry is not morose, but it certainly did become a focus of a lot of her writing, not all of it, but a lot of her writing.
Well, and the film is not just about Ruth herself. It's also about the home, right? She called it the vast library of the female mind, which is the title of the documentary. Say more about that and the significance of that name.
That name comes from one of Ruth's poems called Male Gorillas. And it's a very funny poem, actually. She describes sitting in a diner, a greasy spoon diner, and sitting, eating her eggs in the morning, and then watching this row of, she calls them silverbacks. They're men, older men with gray hair, sitting, their backs to her, just talking, kibitzing, talking about the day, the weather, sports. And she's watching this all unfold, and it's all going in to the vast, confused, she adds the word confused in the poem, the vast, confused library of the female mind. So it's really about how the world enters into her, and the library, her mind, is takes everything in that's around her. And her poetry is very much like that.
So, all right. I want to play another clip from the film. And this, I think at least one other reporter who's interviewed you about this has mentioned it. But first, we're going to hear Ruth talking in the early 1970s about how she stopped writing after her second husband, Walter, died. And then you cut to her reflecting on that in the 1990s. Let's take a listen.
I know how I put it to myself very specifically. I remember saying to myself, the bird has died. And I meant the bird in myself had died, the singer.
But all of a sudden I woke up and I realized, oh my God, how dull everything looked, how dull the world was, how awful.
So what does that say about what writing meant to Ruth Stone?
Well, it's something that was her main focus and passion her whole life. I mean, here we hear the 50-year-old Ruth, and her voice is, well, you heard her voice, very lively. And then you hear the 94-year-old Ruth, and her voice is still lively and intense, but it's a little more crackly and has changed its register a bit. But it just means, and for me, it was about the continuity across time, her passion about writing, that she couldn't give it up completely. And she had to go back and start writing again. She started writing when she was 8 or 9 years old, you know, her first poems. So this has been something throughout her life.
And yet she didn't, I mean, she made her living teaching, but the real recognition, as I understand it, came pretty late in life, right? The big, like the National Book Award, that sort of thing. Would you say, I mean, and you said yourself you had not heard of her. I must admit, I had not heard of her until your documentary came onto our radar. Was she underappreciated, and what changed that toward the end?
Yes, definitely. She was underappreciated throughout much of her lifetime. Her first book, though, did get some notoriety. It was called In an Iridescent Time, and it was before Walter died. And Walter, in fact, had to persuade Harcourt Brace to publish it. They rejected it at first. And he wrote them and said, you're making a terrible mistake. This is a really amazing book and a very talented poet. And they took another look and they said, okay, all right. And they published it. And it was quite a success. She was compared to Sylvia Plath, no mean feat. But then Walter died, and she spent the rest of her time, you know, running around the country, driving around, taking buses and trains around the country to teach. She had no time for self-promotion. She continued writing, but she didn't have time to promote herself. And every artist, unfortunately, knows that promotion and self-promotion is a big part of this business, if you want to call it a business. And so she was pretty much ignored. Harcourt Brace, I think they did publish one more book of hers, a poetry, and then they dropped her. They said, poetry isn't selling, her book isn't, you know, we've done enough. And then a feminist press, Paris Press, took her on, her books on, but a very small press. And then when she won the National Book Award, I think she was in her 80s or maybe, when was it, 80s or early 90s, she did get recognition again. So it really took a long time. But when she first started, she did, you know, there was great promise. And we would have thought that she would have continued ascending the ladder of success. But I think the suicide of her husband, leaving her as a widow with three children, was not a positive thing for her career. You know, she a widow with kids, slightly older at that time already, in her 40s. So I think it's a story of gender discrimination, age discrimination as well.
Last question. We're almost out of time together. What do you hope people will take away from the film and really from the life of Ruth Stone?
Well, I hope it will encourage people to express themselves creatively. I hope this film will make people realize that they can take a tragedy that happened to them and reframe it. And really, like an alchemist turns a common metal into gold, that they will take their experience and transform it into something that is beyond themselves, and that will somehow heal some of their trauma. As someone says in the film, you know, poetry can't bring back your loved ones, but it can put a frame around experience and help you cope with it. That's what I hope the example of her life, her poetry will do. And ultimately, I hope more people find out about her, and that the film will introduce people who don't even think they like poetry to her and to poetry.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Nora Jacobson, director or filmmaker, I should say, of Ruth Stone's Vast Library of the Female Mind.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
The documentary is called Ruth Stone's Vast Library of the Female Mind. It's available to stream on the PBS Passport app and website. Coming up on tomorrow's program, members of Generation X were born from 1965 to 1980. It's the smallest of America's post-war generations and the subject of an exhibit at the Illinois State Museum. We'll have a tour, plus we'll talk with one of Gen X's preeminent chroniclers, the writer Chuck Klosterman. His latest book looks at the decade of the 90s. For now, that's all we have time for today. We'd love to hear what you thought about what we've been talking about, whether it's today's program or anything in the recent past. Maybe you want to suggest a segment for the future. Let us know by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Or you can email us, talk@21stshow.org is the address, talk@21stshow.org. And you can find that number and that email address and our text messaging line and our social media, every other way to contact us. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there, and you can find us most places you get your podcasts, be it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Just search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Owen Henderson. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.